24 hours a day, 24 hours a day.
Okay, so that's from 1995, the New Biles and Layabout. That's the John Peel session version of that song. Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling, renamed as not the BCFM Politics Show now. This week, censorship is definitely the theme again, actually, for as last week. But we'll be starting with the bomb in Beirut Harbour, or the accident, and discussing the enormous blast which destroyed Lebanon's ability to trade. And what if we've been lied to about the dangers of radiation, of nuclear power stations, of Fukushima, ever since the models still used today, which were created around the time of the 75th anniversary this week of the Hiroshima explosion, the first atomic bomb dropped by the United States on Japan. We talked to Chris Busby about what he believed is the failed and flawed model for measuring the dangers of nuclear power plants today, including our very own Hinkley C. And by the way, Chris thinks that'll probably never be built. Also, more on the mass media, what they are not telling us about the extraordinary release of the Ghislaine Maxwell court papers. John Paul Rice, he's a Hollywood film producer, he says, never mind the Me Too movement, he believes that there is an evil paedophile ring in Hollywood. What about the kids, he says, and he's even done a film called A Child's Voice about it, which has been censored this week by Amazon. Censorship always seems to be the main thing we talk about on this program these days, which has itself been censored. And Bulgarian investigative journalist Diliana Gotacheva, she speaks in an exclusive interview to me this week about her discovery of the arms pipeline to the so-called Syrian rebels mainly via Turkey. Anyway, Martin, let's start with this attack over in Beirut. What's your assessment of what went on there?
Well, obviously, the mainstream media are seeing this as a terrible accident. And they're also claiming that, it shows that Lebanon's rulers are incompetent. I see that Rafiq Hariri's son has said, we all know the underlying problem here is Hezbollah and their international connections and so on. So as usual with an incident like this, that's the official level. Then you go dig down a level deeper, and various people like Richard Silverstein, Thierry Masson, other people of some repute are saying, no, what this is an Israeli attack on a Hezbollah arms warehouse, which has gone wrong because it's exploded this other warehouse next door, which has got all this stuff in it, the ammonium nitrate, which exploded. And also there are videos circulating on the internet, which I've seen today, which seem to show a missile hitting just before the second explosion. Now, and of course, this is all within a context in which Israel is ramping up a war on Iran, which requires it to destabilize Lebanon and defang Hezbollah. So we've got means, motive and opportunity all there. Incidentally, the Israelis have offered to help the Lebanese with this, which is extraordinary because they're enemy countries and they've never helped any Arab country with anything apart from supplying arms and providing medical care to ISIS people.
Anyway,
Martin,
one of the most interesting statements was made by Donald Trump himself.
Yes, Trump, of course, I've forgotten to mention.
Saying that this is it looks like a bomb, and he called it an attack. So let's have a listen to Donald Trump now.
Let me begin by sending America's deepest sympathies to the people of Lebanon, where reports indicate that many, many people were killed. Hundreds more were very badly wounded in a large explosion in Beirut. Our prayers go out to all the victims and their families. The United States stands ready to assist Lebanon. We have a very good relationship with the people of Lebanon, and we will be there to help. It looks like a terrible attack.
Are you confident that this was an attack and not an accident?
Well, it would seem like it based on the explosion. I've met with some of our great generals, and they just seemed to feel that it was. This was not some kind of a manufacturing explosion type of event. This was seems to be, according to them, they would know better than I would, but they seemed to think it was a attack. It was a bomb of some kind, yes.
Well, that's pretty clear from Trump.
He's rowed back on that since.
Well, yeah, but you know, there's a lot of rowing back going on. There was and you see that in itself is an indication that there's news management going on. If the basic statements are then rown back on, it's someone is telling you, no, you shouldn't have said that kind of thing. We also heard a little bit, didn't we, at the beginning about this having a mushroom cloud looking like a mini nuke. But I've seen a pretty comprehensive, certainly it didn't look like that to me, and pretty comprehensive explanation saying, well, you know, if it's a nuclear weapon, it's going to have a fireball. This thing didn't have a fireball. But most interestingly, for me, Martin, is the, you know, what you were saying is the context of all of this, because what this bomb on Tuesday evening has done is it's actually completely crippled Lebanon's ability to trade. But amazingly, the mainstream media's narrative right across the West now is blaming Lebanon itself and Lebanon's government. And we've even had President Macron going over there. I mean, who knows? Maybe he's threatening them and he's having secret talks about something that they're planning, more that they're planning to do, and that they better give in right now. Saying that this is the very, very clearly laying the blame at the foot of the Lebanese government for destroying their own port.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at all the things that are being said, it makes me extremely suspicious about this event. Hezbollah had a guy, one of their people was killed in Syria last week. And they generally retaliate for those killings, but they don't immediately retaliate. There's some story last week about there was some infiltration by the Shabar farms and the Israelis killed some people. But then both the Israelis and Hezbollah denied it. Everything is on edge. And basically, it's part of the Israeli strategy to destabilize Lebanon, to make sure that Hezbollah is removed from the government of Lebanon. And don't forget, the Israelis intervened massively in the Lebanese civil war to support their proteges.
Well, look,
and
I mean,
they still regard it as their backyard.
Even closer to, I mean, we didn't report it last Friday, but it Friday morning was reported in the Israeli press that Benny Gantz had instructed the Israeli Defense Force to bomb Lebanese infrastructure if Hezbollah was to harm any of their soldiers. Defense Minister Benny Gantz last week instructed the IDF to bomb Lebanese infrastructure if Hezbollah has harmed any IDF soldiers or Israeli civilians. A senior defense official told Israeli Hayom that Gantz issued the order to prepare such a response during the meetings on Thursday with the IDF chief of staff, Aviv Kochavi, and other members of the general staff. So, I mean, it does seem as if there was any kind of incidents over the weekend, and whether there were or not, the Israeli military was certainly considering bombing infrastructure in Lebanon, and this is possibly the most important piece of infrastructure in the entire country.
Yes, that's right. And, of course, everything is on edge here now. I mean, everybody's waiting. And don't forget, with the election coming up in November in the US and the possibility that Trump may no longer be there, the war faction in Israel are quite keen to get a war with Iran started with the Americans involved, and presumably the British, since we always do as we're told. Most people in Britain probably not paying too much attention to all of this, but we will be dragged in for sure. And that's what possibly this is what Richard Silverstein was suggesting, who is, you know, a pretty good anti-Zionist Jewish activist. He's basically saying that this was a botched attempt to take out a Hezbollah arms dump, but it actually blew up the ammonium nitrate warehouse next door. It wasn't intended to kill as many people as this, but they've messed it up. And that's what's going on here. And neither the Israeli government doesn't want to admit that's what happened, and Hezbollah don't want to admit what's happened, because it then puts them in the firing line. Why are you storing weapons in this warehouse, etc.? But of course, as I said earlier, there are also videos circulating on the internet. They've been taken down, but I've managed to see them this afternoon. They're out there showing a missile hitting the building just before
that certainly is possible, but it's also possible those videos have been
exactly. I'm not saying anything, but people can, if you look out there, you'll see that that's out there and people are commenting on it.
Have been photoshopped or whatever. But look, I'm going to post a link up on our show page to a fascinating piece of film, and this is it's called A Mysterious Explosion. Looks to me like a kind of advanced fuel air bomb. Now, I'm sure, Martin, you'll be familiar with these weapons. It's called the thermobaric weapon. What happens basically is that there's two explosions very rapidly, one after the other. The first one injects a massive amount of high explosive into the atmosphere in a aerosol form. And then the second explosion will then set light to that, and it causes a massive, massive explosion, and it evacuates all the air, and anyone within that area will be suffocated and killed by this. But it has exactly the same kind of, should we say, dome cloud-like shape, and also with a kind of pillar in the middle of it of thick, dense smoke, as the one that we saw in, I mean, so I would just suggest that people have a look at our show page later at thisweek.org.uk at this mysterious explosion, the film of that taken in Syria 7 months ago, and compare it to what happened in Beirut, because it looks to me as if it's exactly the same weapon that was used. And of course, if you set fire to ammonium nitrate, as I don't know if you ever tried this, Martin, but it doesn't explode in a bomb-like way. It certainly explodes, but it's a very slow burn explosion as the fire rips through the chemical. It certainly doesn't explode in the same way as a bomb does. And a bomb is, with those chemicals in the high explosive, sealed in a metal container, a metal tube, or a bomb, will go off in a completely different way, very much more like this one we saw in Syria. So I would suggest that this is almost certainly, and looking at the circumstantial evidence of the news management as well, a bomb attack. Now, let's just look at the implications of that, because does that mean that the Israelis, without telling the Americans, have destroyed this important part of Lebanon in a way that they may have liked to have done years ago, but they couldn't get away with because militarily they couldn't do it, but they can do a sneak attack and use the mass media of the Western world in order to try and convince everybody that it's nothing to do with Israel, it's all the Lebanese government's own fault?
Yeah, that sounds perfectly plausible to me. And don't forget, this afternoon, the Israeli Defense Forces, their air force, has twice attacked Syrian army positions. They've not been doing that up to now. They've been attacking Hezbollah. They've been attacking Iranian positions inside Syria, but they haven't directly attacked Syrian army positions. But apparently they've done that this afternoon. And that's because the right wing in Israel, who are also facing corruption charges, all sorts of things, they are basically pushing for a war with Iran before November, and that something like this would help them to do that. It helps to destabilize Lebanon, which is clearly the strategy, that the economy in Lebanon has been attacked, basically, because unless Hezbollah leaves the government, Lebanon is persona non grata in the West. Now, Lebanon have been embedded in the coalition government in Lebanon for some years now. They're in alliance with Michel Aoun and some elements within the Christian community. The opposition in Syria, in Lebanon, is largely made up of the Sunnis and some of the other Christians. Rafik Hariri started to bloviate about how it's Hezbollah's fault that this has happened. And of course, his father was assassinated, supposedly by Hezbollah, but it was actually the Israelis, as Hezbollah proved in a press conference where they showed the video footage from the Israeli drone, which had actually fired the missile which killed Hariri, because they'd hacked into it. Now, I think it's quite likely that the Israelis either perhaps they didn't expect the level of casualties, I don't know. But in any case, we know that they're trying to destabilize Lebanon at the moment, as are the US deep state. So it's very suspicious that something like this
should happen.
They're
not just destabilizing it by stopping their ability to trade with the outside world, Martin. They've crippled Lebanon.
Well, that's right. And the demand is Hezbollah must leave the government. We need a new government in Lebanon which is friendly to Israel. And everybody else in Israel is going to have their feet held to the fire until Hezbollah is removed. Now, Hezbollah, in fact, are the only properly armed faction in Lebanon. And they're regarded as a patriotic faction, even by Christians, because most of the Shia communities concentrated in the south of Lebanon, south of Beirut and southwards towards the border with Israel. And they've taken the brunt of fighting with Israel. And since 2006, they've established what they call the terms of engagement with Israel, which is Israel is basically in 2006, Hezbollah defeated the Israeli army. And they're actually, because of all the fighting they've been doing in Syria, where they've lost thousands of people, they've become much, much more efficient and well organized than they were even previously. And of course, Hezbollah has got battalions of troops who are Christians, who have Christian pastors, but they're integrated into Hezbollah's military structure. And anybody who knows anything about armies knows that Hezbollah is one of the best organized, best trained, basically probably the top outfit on the planet. That's why they were able to defeat the Israeli Defense Force.
I mean, people might say, why would Benjamin Netanyahu and Benny Gantz do something like this? Well, the answer could well be that they've had a series of weekly demonstrations which have been rocking Israel for months, virtually unreported here in the UK, drawing a growing number of people angry with the government's handling of a second wave of COVID-19 infections and the economic impacts of the pandemic. Political dissatisfaction is at the heart of these protests, according to Deutsche Welle. To put it in two words, the main goal is get out Bibi. Bibi resign, says 59-year-old Tali Etzion from Tel Aviv. So, I mean, he's been hanging on by his fingernails, hasn't he, Netanyahu, to power? And it looks as if you've got regular weekly protests on the Sabbath day on the streets of Israel, with tens of thousands of people protesting against Netanyahu. And it is possibly feasible that he may wish to actually start a war to get himself out of this bind.
Yeah, I mean, you've got a number of factors. He's got a personal interest in distraction from his own personal problems. But there's a long-running desire on the part of the deep state in Israel to annex the West Bank, to annex the Golan Heights, to annex Lebanon up to the Litani River so they can get the water resources. And they've been destabilizing other countries around them all along. That's part of the Yinon plan going back to the 1980s to balkanize states adjacent to Israel and so on. I mean, they basically are belligerent. And they've got the biggest army in the Middle East. They've got hundreds of nuclear weapons. But they still couldn't beat Hezbollah in 2006. Their tanks were wiped out by people coming forward with anti-tank weaponry. And Hezbollah have now got thousands of missiles. And if there is a war with Lebanon, then basically the infrastructure of Israel is going to be blown to bits. And, of course, their response to that, to blow up the infrastructure of Lebanon, that won't stop Hezbollah doing what they're going to do. But Hezbollah don't want to fight, nor does the Syrian army, nor does the Russian army, nor does the Iranian army, nor does the Chinese army. But ultimately, this is what's going to happen if the fools in charge continue on their reckless course.
I mean, let's go back to this idea that the Lebanese government are responsible for their own problems. I mean, I don't think that anybody with more than one or half a brain cell would say that, because actually what's going on is there's been an international economic warfare against that country, really, by the likes of the IMF and the Western financial bankster powers.
Well, that's right. And up to now, Lebanon has been, in a way, because it was so volatile, outside powers have tried to prop up the rather rickety political structure inside Lebanon. Because, you know, Lebanon was in a civil war in the 1970s, in which, as I said earlier, the Israelis had a very big hand. And Macron, of course, you've got to remember that France used to be the colonial power, and they were only kicked out of Syria after a massive uprising.
Well, now again this week, apparently they're back. Well, just one final thing on this horrific bomb attack. We reckon
that's what it is.
Well, I mean, I think I don't think there's much doubt about it. You know, the idea, if you look at the difference between if you set fire to a warehouse full or bags or stacks of ammonium nitrate, it just simply doesn't go bang in the same way as that bomb appeared to go bang. And I would agree with the the US military in this case, probably, you know, the Israelis didn't decide, they didn't really particularly want to tell the Americans that they were going to do something like that, or whoever has done this.
Well, that's right, because they've got an interest in dragging the US into a war in the Middle East. So they do stuff to get things going so that the Americans will be dragged in. And they don't necessarily tell the Americans that they're going to do these things.
But the interesting side is that another thing is that there was lots and lots of film of it. And the reason there was lots of film of it is because there was a fire close to the place of the impact of the bomb, or wherever this was. And so that obviously meant that people would be filming the fire. So this reminds me a little bit of the Twin Towers, Martin, where, you know, you've got to have two aircraft hit two towers. Otherwise, no one is filming when the second one goes in to make sure that there is actually film of this bomb going off. That's where this fire comes in. So that could possibly have been a deliberately set fire in order to make sure that there was a lot of attention on the bomb when it actually went off.
It's possible. And of course, with the plausible deniability, Israel said nothing to do with us, nothing to do with us. But as Hezbollah proved, to my satisfaction, they were the ones who assassinated Rafiq Hariri Sr. And that, of course, was determined to try and destabilize Lebanon. And we know, going back to the 1960s, 70s, that the Israelis were bombing Lebanon with car bombs and all sorts in order to provoke civil war in Lebanon, because it suited their book for there to be a civil war in Lebanon. That's their track record. So that's the history.
Okay,
so
now also...
The people in Lebanon, especially from the Hezbollah side, will be very much thinking, well, this is probably the Israelis.
I mean, this also, it? Martin, comes against a backdrop, not only of the horrific attacks, economic warfare there's been on Lebanon, but also the fires at key sites in Iran that have been taking place over the last few months. So these fires also haven't really been reported. The Iranians have been playing them down to a certain extent, but we've seen explosions and possibly at these various ballistic missile sites. So, you know, you can imagine, can't you, is a factory building weapons in Israel was bombed and attacked, that there would be enormous amounts of news around it, but not when it's in Iran.
Well, that's right. And the reason the Iranians are playing it down, and it's also maybe the case that Hezbollah will play down what they think that what they know about what's happened in Beirut, is because they're just trying to get through to November without a war. Because it's possible that Trump may then be removed, and the pressure will be released a bit. As you can imagine, if you are a leader in one of these organizations or one of the countries that are under this kind of assault, you're trying to avoid getting into an all-out war, because that's a disaster for you. So you basically have to suck up an awful lot of punishment without retaliation. The Syrian army would be absolutely within its rights in international law to attack the air bases from which these planes flew out today to attack their troops. That's what if somebody attacked the Akrotiri base in Cyprus, unless it was the locals like Aoka B, the British would then go and attack the base where the people had fired the missiles from or the planes had flown from. But the Syrians can't. The Lebanese can't. There's one rule for them and another rule for us, and that's the way it is.
An official Israeli military source denied carrying out the attack, which is interesting because they actually said, we did not carry out this attack. That implies it was actually an attack. So that's quite an interesting angle to all of this. Mm. But anyway, Martin, what's your in summary? Do you think how much will countries like Lebanon, Syria, and Iran, what sorts of massive attacks, if this is an attack, will they be prepared to accept before they start to strike back?
Well, they'll accept virtually anything because they haven't got any options. They really don't want to have a major war. You saw the Iranians, they had a fake aircraft carrier and they bombed it the other day on video so the Americans can see, this is what we can do to your aircraft carriers. They're doing everything they can to do what you might call, if you're a butterfly or a beetle, you've got all these poisonous colours and you're trying to show them the poisonous colours. If you eat me, you're going to die. And that's where they're at with their strategy. And they can't afford to be silly about it. Yeah, because they're, you know, a major war, it will hurt the Israelis. And they, of course, are sort of by and large better off than their neighbours. And they're used to shopping and being able to go to the beach and go on foreign holidays. They will be shocked when the missiles come raining down on them. But, of course, other people in the neighbourhood are very well aware of how brutal warfare is.
I mean, the other side of all of this is, do you think it will be a successful tactic to help Netanyahu and Benny Gantz stay in power?
Well, if you look at Netanyahu and Benny Gantz, it's dumb and dumber, really. There's no real forces or voices for peace left in the mainstream of Israeli politics. You've got a substantial minority of Israeli citizens who are Arab Palestinians, and if there was a peace faction in the Knesset, they would work with them to change the
But many of these demonstrators are many of these demonstrators are Jewish, Martin.
Well, yes, because Netanyahu's a crook. So what they're objecting to is him ripping off the state, which is perfectly legitimate. But those same people probably have Benny Gantz, basically, was in charge of everything that happened in Gaza last year. And he presents himself as nearly as militant.
Well, hang on, what you're talking about here, because, you know, it wasn't reported that much, was literally hundreds of people being shot dead. Just simply for walking over a piece of land, and they were shot
for trying to march back towards where they used to live before they were all put in the concentration camp in Gaza.
Which is the irony here being, this is about the right to return, which of course the Zionists claim this right, but then if anyone else wants to claim it, then they shoot them dead.
Well, that's right. And, you know, we've got US imperialism with its global designs, and we've also got Israeli imperialism with its rather more regional interests, but they are very belligerent. And ultimately, of course, the belligerence of the Israelis ends up with people dying in bomb attacks in Western Europe. That's what it means. They are risking our lives with their belligerent attitude.
Okay, but in the background to all of this, of course, is the much wider conflict between the United States and China, which is, you know, basically saber-rattling militarily, but a full-on trade war is developing there. In the meantime, Martin, thanks for pointing out to me last week about this China being on its highest ever flood alert, as 38 million people have been evacuated in China. Now, I hadn't heard anything about this, but that's a lot of people to evacuate from an area which is a floodplain of a dam.
Yeah. But every year, the West says that this dam's going to collapse. I've read various analyses of this.
Let's just make it clear. This is called the Three Gorges Dam, it's looking at photographs of it. It does look as if parts of the dam from satellites, parts of the dam seem to be bending from above.
Yeah, well, one of the things that's happened is they're letting water flow through the dam because, you know, it's full, and cities downstream have been flooded. Wuhan, the so-called center of the coronavirus crisis, has been under floods this week. And the other people have suggested that it may well be, if we've got virus attacks and all these other things going on, that weather warfare may be involved here. Maybe it's possible that the people can make the rain up in the mountains in Tibet particularly bad, and that puts extra
pressure
on the Chinese
government. But it's also just as possible, Martin, just as possible that the design of this dam and this river wasn't quite up to the job. They didn't realise that there was going to be changes in the climate that were going to mean that the dam was going to have to allow much more water to pass through it rather than to use it for power generation.
Yeah, and apparently it hasn't really generated much power anyway. But anyway, I mean, all of these questions, I mean, one of the problems with a centralized system like China is if you get a white elephant project like building a dam, and it seems to be, you know, it really fits the bill as a sort of, you know, only China could build a dam this big, you know. But the danger with that is that you build a big dam, but it's the wrong dam and you shouldn't have built it. But anyway, even if that's the case, you're then vulnerable. And of course, in any warfare, you know, the obvious thing that the Chinese can sink any US aircraft carrier, the dam busters from the US can blast this dam and flood the whole of central China.
Yeah, well, maybe they would.
It's obviously a national security risk.
It's now vulnerable. I would hope that the Chinese are keeping a very, very close eye on this Three Gorges Dam. It's actually in the Hubei province.
There is a regular drumbeat of the dam's going to fall down year in, year out from anti-China people.
Yeah, but just a minute. This is on the Yangtze River in Hubei province. Beijing's admitted that it's a 2.4-kilometre span, Three Gorges Dam, is deformed. after the record flooding. They quoted the operator, the Chinese news agency, of the world's largest hydroelectric gravity dam, saying that some non-structural peripheral parts of the dam had indeed buckled. That the dam was a pet project of the late Premier Li Peng and a monumental pride of the nation when it blocked and diverted Asia's largest river in 1997. That was the same year that Hong Kong was handed back by the Brits. But that took place on the Yangtze River. So if this dam goes, will we know, a bit like Beirut, will we know if it's an accident or deliberate?
Well, I mean, it might be an accident, or as I say, it might be deliberate. But don't forget, as I just mentioned earlier, Pompeo said we're no longer going to tolerate China. Now, if you're going to go to war with China, you've got to break their legs, knock their dam down, blame them for what's going on with the Uyghur minority, stir things up in Hong Kong, have a trade war, try and shut down Huawei, arrest their people. It's a pattern's beginning to appear here. And, of course, what they're doing is trying to push the Communist Party into a corner so they then lash out and then they can say, oh, look what they're doing. Blah, blah, blah. And it's reckless stuff considering how integrated China is with the world economy. But there you go. These people think like that. It's 19th century realpolitik with 21st century weapons. Absolutely bonkers, but there we are.
Well, yesterday was 75 years since the dropping of the bomb on Hiroshima. On this program, we have looked at all sorts of conspiracy theories or actual evidence, in fact, that the bombs that were dropped on Nagasaki and Hiroshima by the United States Air Force in July 1940, or was it August, actually, I think it was,
yeah, 1945,
The beginning of August, were in fact including some uranium which had been gotten from the Nazi uranium enrichment program. Anyway, that's a fascinating tale in itself, but in a way peripheral, because Martin, we're looking now at the expansion of nuclear weapons. All countries, China, Russia, possibly even the Israelis, but certainly the US and the NATO countries that have nuclear weapons, like France, for example, are upgrading their nuclear weapons. And in the background, we've got bubbling along, haven't we, the increase in nuclear power, nuclear energy, with the Chinese and the French building a nuclear power station called Hinkley C. What do you make of the way this is all going? Because, you know, for example, after Fukushima, the Germans cancelled their nuclear program completely. They said this is a completely crazy technology, effectively. It's far too expensive. We're going to get rid of it completely after Fukushima. So what do you make of the way this is all going? It seems now that we're supposed to be expanding. There's even a new China-only station, nuclear power station, they're applying for in Bradwell, which has been closed for some years, down in Suffolk as well.
Well, I mean, you've got to make some distinction between military nukes and civilian nukes. I mean, there's obviously a massive amount of overlap. I mean, civilian nuclear energy basically only developed as a cover for military uses. So for example, the Indians developed their nuclear
weapons. Iran is planning Canadian nuclear weapons. Is Iran planning to build a nuclear weapon?
No, I don't think they are, because there's no strategic purpose to it. Even if they had one, it wouldn't help them. That what they're doing is they are preparing to fight, but they've actually admit that the top religious leadership has said that nuclear weapons are un-Islamic. They've issued fatwas against them. They've always maintained that what they want is civilian nuclear power. And of course, all the huffing and puffing, the Israelis have not signed the non-proliferation treaty, the Iranians have, and they've accepted all sorts of inspections. The Israelis won't sign the treaty because they've got loads of nuclear weapons and they're not going to give them up. And of course, the Logan Act in the US says that any country that develops nuclear weapons unofficially should have complete sanctions on them, which is why the Israelis never admit openly that they've got these nuclear weapons, although we know they have them because of Mordecai Vanunu's revelations some years ago. And you know, the danger of any, you know, there's so many things to go wrong here, isn't there? Leaving aside the fact that the waste from these nuclear power plants is going to be a problem for generations and generations to come. It's only made to seem viable as long as the waste is magicked out of the equation.
That's right, the waste will go along with the debt, won't it? That will also... But anyway, I thought we'd have a chat with Dr. Chris Busby, who's been a major figure around the UK in helping people who have been, for example, living near nuclear power stations who have caught the disease leukemia, particularly childhood leukemia clusters. So on Hiroshima Day, that is to say 75 years after the exploding of the first atomic bomb, let's have a listen to what Chris Busby has to say, but particularly about the way that we now measure whether or not nuclear power stations are safe.
This is a decision people have to make on the basis of their ideas about whether nuclear is carbon dioxide free and whether it should be used in order to have a low carbon footprint with regard to climate change. And so a lot of the greenies have now decided that climate change is a much bigger threat than the radiation that's likely to come from the nuclear industry. And of course, they're entitled to do that. But they should do it on the basis of the real truth about the health effects of releases from these nuclear sites, rather than some, you know, pie in the sky nonsense that's peddled by the nuclear industry and also then parroted by people like George Monbiot, you know, who actually knows nothing at all about radiation or radiation biology or radiation risk or anything. I mean, he's just, and also other people, there's another guy, Mark something or another, who embraces nuclear on the basis of totally crazy ideas about the way about the risks from it. Now, I'll say a few things about the risks from it, because that's something that I've studied quite a lot and published quite a lot about. And those risks were originally studied by the Atomic Bomb Casualty Committee, who followed the people who were exposed at Hiroshima and Nagasaki for their lifespan. It's called the Lifespan Study. So anyway, the point is that the risk model, what emerges from this is that the risk model that they obtained from doing that big study is completely wrong. It's just totally and completely wrong by orders of magnitude, by factors of between 1,000 and 10,000, which is why when you go and study people living near nuclear sites like Hinckley and Bradwell, which I have studied, you know, and published in the peer review literature, you find excess risk of cancer, particularly female breast cancer. Also, I looked at Trasvenna's nuclear power station in Wales. Again, we had a fivefold excess of breast cancer in women. But you find that there are excess risks of childhood leukemia in just about every single nuclear site that anybody has studied. But they continue to deny causation on the basis of this Hiroshima study.
Okay, so what would you say? You know, how do you, would you counter those arguments? What evidence have you got that this study is so wrong?
Well, the Hiroshima study is based on, or was based, it started in 1952. I mean, it was an epidemiological study of about 80,000 people who were exposed at the time of the bomb. And they were originally to be compared with a control group, people who weren't in the city at the time of the bomb, in order to see how many cancers there were. And then to see how many cancers there were on the basis of what dose they got from the immediate explosion. And so this study carried on. It was funded by the Americans. The first thing you could say about it, which is what Alice Stewart said, is that it was a survivor population. So by 1952, when they assembled all these people, an awful lot of people who'd been exposed to the radiation had died. But anyway, putting that to one side, You can then look at these people and see how many cancers they got according to how far they were from the explosion. Now, the explosion produces gamma rays and neutrons, external radiation, and that's absorbed by the people's bodies that live there. And if they're really close to it, when it went off, they were just incinerated. Then if they're about 500 meters a kilometer away, some of them survived and then went on to get cancer. But after 2 kilometers, nobody got any dose at all, because that's when the radiation runs out of steam. So what the study did is it looked at the dose according to their distance from when the bomb went off, and it compared that to the number of cancers they got. But by 1973, suddenly they discovered that the people who were not in the city, you know, the control group, started to show up with lots of cancers, and they said, well, this is impossible. I mean, they weren't even exposed to the radiation. So they kicked out the control group. They said, this must be a false control group. So they took it out altogether. And after that, they just compared high dose to medium dose to low dose, and they drew a straight line through the whole thing, and that gave them the number of cancers you get per unit dose. But there was a huge problem, and the problem was that that bomb, when it exploded, sucked an awful lot of water vapor up into the air, and then the bomb constituents themselves, the uranium that the bomb was made of, and 95% of it hadn't fissioned, it was only 5% that fissioned, turned into particles, and that those particles fell on the ground as black rain. And this black rain fell for at least 7 or 8 kilometers away from the bomb, from the detonation. So in around about 2000, 2005, so that sort of time, studies began to show that people who were nowhere near the bomb were getting cancer. Okay, the control group people had got high levels of cancer. They weren't even in the city. They just came in afterwards. So obviously those people were exposed to something that were giving them cancer. And this something was the black rain. Well, secret documents that I saw when I was doing the court case, and I'm not allowed to talk about it apart from saying that, you know, the fact that those documents exist are there in the transcripts of the court case, which are public data. They can be taken forward to show that the concentration of uranium inside the bomb, in the black rain, was extremely high, that the doses from the black rain were extremely high. And the reason I can say this is that in 2014, an American document from Rocky Flats, where they processed this uranium into the bomb material, was released for public consumption in 2014. It was a 1976 document. And when you look at it, you can see that the amounts of a missing uranium isotope called uranium-234 were absolutely enormous. They were absolutely enormous. So what happened is that the study, the Hiroshima study, is made completely false by the fact that the cancers were not caused by the external radiation. They were caused by the exposure to internal uranium particles from the black rain, which were in the water supply and in the dust when people were rebuilding the city from 1945 to 1950. There was huge amounts of dust because they were, like, you know, pulling all the ruins down and rebuilding it and so on. And everyone is inhaling the dust or drinking the water contaminated with this U-234. So this is big news, because what this means is that the risk model that they obtained from this Hiroshima study is completely wrong. Now, that's the same risk model that's used to argue that cancers near Hinkley Point and cancers near Bradwell — I found high levels of breast cancer near Bradwell also, and that's been published in the literature — those cancers are real, and they're caused by the radiation. They're caused by the uranium released from the stacks and other isotopes released from the stacks of the nuclear power stations environment.
Nuclear Fuels, Chris, would say that actually they don't release any uranium from the stacks, that it's all filtered out.
Yes, well, they do say that, but actually there are papers that show that just isn't true. And in fact, there was the data that they brought out for when EDF were building were applying for the license to build Hinkley Point. There was an environmental impact assessment made in which the concentrations of uranium were actually measured in the soil around the site, you know, as a sort of background to what was going to happen when they bring in the new reactor. And we analyzed — I did with Cecily Collingridge and I, she's dead now, but we analyzed that data, and we found that there was a huge number of tons of extra uranium in the soil around the Hinkley Point site. And that uranium was in the upper soil, so it wasn't in the lower soils, because they actually did cause. So we could show that the upper soil contained a lot more uranium than the lower soil. And this uranium had been coming from the stacks, and also from being pumped out into the sea where it gets washed back. So we also had a trend with distance from the sea. So all that uranium is in the mud. And not only that, but we actually took samples and measured the uranium. And there is uranium also in the spectra that we obtained by Freedom of Information Act requests to the operators of Hinkley Point. I think maybe even to EDF, I can't remember. I know Environment Agency, that was it. So we got the data, and we could show that there was excess uranium in the mud. Now that mud is being dredged now and taken over to the Welsh side and just dumped off Cardiff, where you've got millions of people living just near all that stuff.
Well, yeah, but you see, British Nuclear Fuels, the operators of these plants, will say there is no uranium in the local environment. They'll say, actually, that uranium, Chris, stays in the reactor itself, on, and it just heats water up. It doesn't go anywhere. It certainly doesn't go into the atmosphere.
Well, that just isn't true. I mean, if you look at the United Nations Scientific Committee on the Effects of Atomic Radiation, the 2000 edition is the last time that they that they released data on the releases, their tables from 1990 to 1999. So that's 9 or 10 years of data from every nuclear site in the world. And one of the tables, you know, one of the rows in those tables has Hinkley site, has the Hinkley reactors, Hinkley A, Hinkley B. So there they are, you know. I mean, anybody can see that.
How does the uranium get through a great big steel pressure vessel? I mean, it can't just go through metal, can it?
No, of course not. But the thing is that they vent this stuff through stacks. They vent the cooling water through stacks, and the cooling water gets contaminated by leakages and broken up fuel rods and all sorts of crap. You know, I mean, it just is the case. You can see in the tables that they say particulate releases, and these particulate releases are releases of particles of uranium from the fuel rods, and they go out, they are released every year into the air. I mean, there they are in the tables. There's quite a lot of it, I can tell you. I mean, I can send you the tables and you can see them. There they are. So, I mean, they could say, oh, it can't come out of here because it's impossible. But whether it's impossible or not, it does.
Okay, so the latest news we've got from Hinkley is that there has been a tower that has collapsed at Hinkley, which released a dust cloud in the whole area. A spokesperson for EDF, which is building the site, said the silo suffered structural damage. And this was back on the 10th of June. It doesn't sound as if the people constructing it are really doing a very good job if they've allowed a large silo to collapse on site.
Well, there's another thing. Yes, I agree with you. And there's another thing. They're the turbines. I mean, these things have oil seals. You know, in order to drive the electricity through the turbines, you've got to have a shaft which runs through metal. And on one side of it, you get all the steam and all the stuff. And on the other side, you get the air. And the oil for those things is incinerated regularly. They have incinerators. They just burn it. So there are lots of ways in which this stuff can get out. I mean, there's the cooling ponds as well, you know. So these things get thrown into the cooling ponds, that you know, like to cool off, you know. And then of course they go off to Sellafield to be whatever they do there, you know, recycled or turned into plutonium or whatever, you know, reprocessed. That was it. And it gets out of Sellafield, I can tell you, because we've measured it. I mean, I've measured. I tell you one thing that I did recently, which hasn't got out, is that I got an air filter from somebody living in just within 5-6 kilometers of, I think maybe Covington, somewhere like that, from a vehicle. I asked them. I've been asking for vehicle air filters in order to see particles inside them, if there are any, because there's a method of looking at particles called CR39. It's a bit like a photographic method. So you put it next to the air filter membrane, and you leave it for a long time, and then you get these little tracks that you can see when you develop it with potassium hydroxide, and you can look at it through a microscope. So there was this filter that was sent to me by this person who lived near Hinkley Point, and there it is. There's a really seriously dangerous uranium particle in the car air filter. So if it can get into an engine air filter, it can certainly get into your lung.
So that's Dr. Chris Busby there. He's an expert on radiation, effects of radiation, particularly around nuclear power stations. Been involved in many court cases and detected what he believes, and what to a certain extent the courts have also agreed, are leukemia clusters around these places, and particularly childhood leukemia. Martin, what do you think from what you've heard there? I mean, he's in a way, I mean, he's a fascinating idea, isn't it? Someone has sent him an air filter from their car to check, and he's found uranium in it.
Well, I mean, you've got to listen to it, haven't you? Nuclear power clearly isn't safe. I mean, the nuclear power has been developed on the back of nuclear weapons. The Indian nuclear bombs, what they did is they bought CANDU nuclear reactors from Canada. So they were basically peaceful nuclear reactors, but they only bought them so that they could develop nuclear material for bombs. And, you know, AQ Khan obviously develops the Pakistani bomb on a different basis. People have known ever since Hiroshima and John Hershey's reports that nuclear radiation is just terribly bad for you, and it lasts for thousands of years, and basically to be avoided if you can.
One of the interesting things about Chris Busby is he pointed to George Monbiot there. They were both members of the Green Party, as I was actually back in the 1990s. And George Monbiot, when it came to the time of the Fukushima disaster, actually published in The Guardian a hatchet job on Chris Busby. So they had formerly been colleagues, but obviously Chris Busby did not have a column in The Guardian. And George Monbiot really attacked him, basically saying that, you know, we need nuclear power. Interesting that happened just after the Fukushima accident, where the nuclear industry was so much in question. Indeed, the German authorities decided to cancel their program completely.
Yeah, well, let's bring in the Stuxnet virus here. A cyber attack on the Iranian nuclear program, which caused all of their centrifuges to blow out. And the Israelis and the Americans have basically all but said, yeah, that we did that. Wasn't it brilliant? But of course, it then got into the world's computer systems and may have had a role in what happened at Fukushima. Obviously, Fukushima is an absolute disaster. You've got loads of radioactive water being leached into the Pacific. We could mention, if we're doing nuclear topic, the bombings of Bikini Atoll in the 1950s, eventually with hydrogen bombs by the Americans, and huge plumes of radioactive dust were allowed to flow over the Marshall Islands, and loads of people subsequently were exposed. lots of military
Martin, there were also, for example, whole loads of fishermen that were also exposed, Japanese fishermen. And there are people who say that these were actually deliberately not warned of the test so that they could be part of the test.
Well, you may say so. The original bombing, they were testing what they were doing. I mean, all the justification for it about, you know, there would have to have been a major assault on Japan. Well, that's debatable. Japan was completely surrounded and was under an economic blockade. And what was really probably significant is that the Russians had declared war on Japan and they were moving through Manchuria towards Korea, and they'd have ended up in Korea. And then if the Americans and the British say, well, we don't want to lose the casualties to invade Japan, the Russians will say, well, we've already taken 20 million. We can take another 2 million, but we're having Japan. And at that point, the bombs are dropped. The Japanese don't want to be taken over by the Russians, and the Americans come in and with all the consequences that we know. I do think, actually, that going on about they didn't have to use nuclear weapons, Tokyo had been bombed with conventional explosives not long before, and 100,000 people died. There is no real difference in killing people, but the difference, I suppose, about radioactivity is I'm quite sure it's probably not safe in Hiroshima even today, all these years later, whereas in Tokyo, people probably are, even though they were incinerated in 1945.
I mean, some people have said, Martin, there was no strategic need, as you say there, to use the atomic weapon on Japan, and also that this was a deliberate test on Japanese people on Hiroshima Day 75 years ago that didn't need to take place. Indeed, some have even suggested that President Roosevelt, who was said to be against the use of the atomic bomb on Japan, died literally just at the end of the war in Europe, a couple of months before the bombs were dropped.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's still lots of debate about how the decision was made. Quite a lot of the top brass in the US, Eisenhower, for example, said there was no need for that. And he ultimately became president of the US. I think the real message was being sent to the Russians. Look what we've got. Don't forget. And also the recklessness, you know, we're quite prepared. And we know that a plan was cooked up by Churchill and others to atomic bomb the Soviet Union's major cities, and they were working on that. So it's probably just as well that the Soviet spy network was extremely good, so they knew all about this stuff. At the Potsdam conference, when Truman said to Stalin, "We've got a new weapon, you know," and he said, "Oh well, I hope you use it on the Japanese." And people who were standing around thought, well, Stalin doesn't seem to understand what this is, but apparently Stalin knew exactly what it was because he got his own scientists working on exactly that, and of course, lots of his scientists were getting information directly from the people working on the atomic bomb and the Manhattan Project. Many of whom were communists.
From Klaus Fuchs, who did his studying in Bristol, by the way.
Yeah.
Also, on this very topic of whether or not it was a good idea or necessary to use the atom bomb back in August 1945, probably one of the best books on it is by a guy called Gar Alperovitz. That's A-L-P-E-R-O-V-I-T-Z, Gar Alperovitz. And that's called The Decision to Use the Atomic Bomb. And that really does include all sorts of interesting angles on those arguments which were used and counter-arguments which were put by particularly by politicians in the military and in the United States about whether or not this was going to be necessary. Of course, we know, Martin, that actually if a weapon has been developed, those that have developed it would rather like to see it used in anger because that gives them an idea of how useful it might be in the future in a subsequent war.
Absolutely. And, you know, there was no basically Hiroshima and Nagasaki, 67 cities in Japan, including Tokyo, have been reduced to rubble. But these two cities have been left so that they could be atomic bombed with no other damage to them, so that they could then see exactly what the damage was when you just use an atomic bomb with nothing else involved. So don't forget that many of the people who developed the atomic bomb were profoundly anti-Nazi people, and they developed it because they feared that Hitler would get it. But once Hitler had been defeated, they were not happy at all about it being used on Japan. But as you know, realpolitik doesn't work like that.
What do you make of the research that I've been doing and others have been doing on the Nazi enriched uranium program? Because it certainly, with arrests in Germany of people who are in possession of nuclear material that they won't tell the authorities where they found it. We've also had the German government actually itself coming out and saying there was a nuclear enrichment program, which they previously had denied. And then, of course, there's the testimony of various people involved in this submarine, U-234. Funnily enough, we just heard about an isotope of uranium called U-234. This is a German submarine called U-234, which was heading across the Atlantic, containing allegedly large amounts of enriched uranium and also the infrared fuses necessary for the plutonium bomb. So there is some evidence for there being a German nuclear program, which deliberately wasn't used in order to make it a bargaining chip with the Allies at the end of the war.
I think that's a very interesting thesis. And as you know, deals were being done at the end of the war with senior Nazi figures, not Hitler. Nobody told him anything. And it's quite possible that some of the material that was dropped on Japan had been developed in the Nazi nuclear program and given to the Western powers as part of a deal Bormann, as we know, ended up in Argentina and continued to operate.
Well, it's to allow safe passage,
under the cover of Western intelligence services.
A lot of these war criminals were very concerned about what was going to happen to them at the end of the war. They needed to buy their safe passage at the end, didn't they?
Yeah. So there's a lot of evidence to suggest that sort of thing went on. And when the Allies took over in Japan, the Kempeitai and the power structure, they'd carried out loads of biological and chemical warfare experiments on lots of different people. And they said, well, if you want this material, you're going to have to let us off. And if you let us off, we'll give it you all. And that was the deal that was done. And that we're going to move on now, I think, not to talk about biological warfare labs, but I mean, the Western biological warfare and chemical warfare program came from that era. And it's still continuing.
Well, I mean, yes, you're right. We are going to move on to look at Diliana Gatancheva, who I spoke to this week, Martin, and she was really wanted to talk about a discovery that she made During the so-called civil war in Syria, really this is a proxy war that was waged by the NATO countries against Syria, an attempt at a regime change, which was blocked mainly by the intervention of the Russians. And she wanted to talk to me about her website called Arms Watch, and particularly what caused her to start publishing there and to set up the site. And this is about arms smuggling into Turkey and Syria during that Syrian so-called civil war, which she was saying was completely actually fueled by NATO, not in just in terms of arms, but also in terms of money and specific units and individuals that were being sent in to as an attempt to regime change Syria, basically a mercenary army sponsored by NATO. So let's have a listen to her now.
In December of 2016, I was in Aleppo in northern Syria, reporting on the Battle of Aleppo, when the terrorists retreated from their positions. I was able to get inside Al-Qaeda warehouses full of heavy weapons, and I was able to film the identification marks of these weapons and their country of origin, and later on to trace back these weapons to the country of origin of these weapons and their original supplier. In this case, it was the government of the United States, Saudi Arabia as well. And the manufacturer was my country, Bulgaria. I filmed 122 millimeter Grad rockets originating from Bulgaria. And I found these weapons in a warehouse of Al-Qaeda in Syria. I traced back these weapons, and later on I received leaked documents about 350 diplomatic flights from Eastern Europe via different routes, but the final destination of these weapons was Syria or Yemen or Africa.
Did you manage to discover who was masterminding these operations?
Yes, absolutely. These flights, diplomatic flights, they were diplomatic and they were performed by the Azeri state-run company Silkway Airlines. So in order for flights to be diplomatic and to receive and to be granted diplomatic clearance, a state, in this case Azerbaijan, must apply for diplomatic clearance. So in this case, we are talking about a whole international weapons shipment network involving the governments of many countries, with Azerbaijan being I wouldn't say the organizer, because this air company, Silkway Airlines, was chartered by the governments of the United States, Saudi Arabia, and the United Emirates. And these weapons originating from the Balkans or other countries in Eastern Europe, including my country, Bulgaria, these weapons were transported on these diplomatic flights to different locations, but they were later on smuggled to Syria. And I filmed a lot of weapons in the hands of terrorists in Syria, and I traced back these same weapons to their original supplier. It was, in my case, it was the government of the U.S. Special Operations Command, or the government of the United States, and also Saudi Arabia, their Ministry of Defense. These two governments supplied weapons to militants in Syria, and I will use the word terrorists because this was Al-Nusra Front operating in Aleppo, and Al-Nusra Front at that point was the Syrian affiliate of Al-Qaeda in Syria.
Okay, Silkway Airlines, Martin, and Special Operations Command. Now, the Silkway Airlines, if you have a look at them, they basically operate the old Soviet-style equipment. But of course, Azerbaijan is, although it's a former Soviet republic, it's now very much more friendly to the West. So it looks as if NATO have decided that they're going to use some of these newly arrived NATO nations in order to create a smuggling operation to support their proxy mercenary troops trying to overthrow governments.
Yeah, and of course, one of the ways, it's the same, if you remember in Operation Cyclone, and you remember the film Charlie Wilson's War, they needed to have Soviet bloc weaponry, because the Mujahideen fighting in Afghanistan, if they'd all had M16s or SA-80 rifles, it would have been obvious it was arming them. So they needed to get Soviet-era weapons. And, of course, the Israelis provided those because they captured a hell of a lot of Soviet tanks and military equipment in their various wars with Syria and Egypt. And the same will probably be the case, you know, the militants inside Syria, many of them are not Syrian at all, of course, they will be using the same sort of weaponry as their opponents, the Syrian Arab Army. And so they could, you know, plausibly claim that they'd captured this weaponry from the enemy. But of course, she's got drilled down to the detail there. All of this weaponry has actually got, it's got serial numbers on it and so forth. And basically what they've done is they've gone around East European countries, hoovered all this stuff up and smuggled it in to give to their protégés, Al-Qaeda. And, of course, it was their protégés, Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, and their protégés, Al-Qaeda in Syria. And anybody listening to this show who doesn't realise by now that Al-Qaeda is a front organisation for the Saudi intelligence services and therefore for the Western intelligence services just hasn't been paying attention.
So the activities of Silkway Airlines have been mainly in Afghanistan. They've had two crashes, one in 2011 and one in 2016 in southern Afghanistan, another one at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, and also down in Chad. But these people seem to be quite clearly, I just think it's useful to know which airlines, and this is a cargo airline, have been taking this equipment. And another fascinating thing I think she said there was looking at the end user certificates. So a lot of this equipment was manufactured in the former Soviet Union, Eastern European countries, which are now part of NATO. They are making these weapons, and then they're exporting them, with the so-called end user being the United States. But then, funnily enough, they're ending up in the hands of al-Nusra and al-Qaeda.
Well, yes, and she's done a very good job of documenting it, and she's also paid a pretty high price for it. I mean, she's probably one of the best investigative journalists operating on the planet today. But her life isn't easy because the people who don't want her to do what she does are making her life difficult.
What about Special Operations Command? They're the people who she was saying effectively masterminding this whole operation.
Yeah, well, that's the way you do it, isn't it? The politicians only need to know what they need to know. Meanwhile, you get on with doing what you're doing. And even if you get caught, you just say, well, nothing to do with me, Gov. That's how it works. I mean, so everybody knows.
Special Operations Command, I think, is worthy of note, actually, because they are they sit alongside the entire "we want to dominate the world" unified command structure, where we've got things like AFRICOM, which is the American military dominating Africa. We've got EUCOM, which is the American military dominating the EU. We've got CENTCOM, which is the American military dominating the Middle East. We've got SOUTHCOM, which is the American military dominating South America. So they've got, and in fact, they've got commands for all parts of the world, including many of them actually based in Florida, some, but actually some of the most important ones based in Stuttgart in Germany, these commands. But Special Operations Command straddles the entire world. It is the unified combatant command charged with overseeing all special operations in the component commands of Army, Marine Corps, Navy and Air Force of the whole of the US armed forces all over the world. So an interesting little unit we don't hear all that much about.
Well, apart from all of the kind of, SAS, who dares wins, green berets, all of the kind of, Hollywood style stuff that we get told about these great heroes who infiltrate. We can't tell you everything that they do, but it's a good job they're there. Otherwise, the terrorists might kill us in our beds. And of course they are in fact embedded with the worst terrorists on the planet. The Saudis or that they've been supporting militant Islamist extremism for years and years and years and years and years. But nevertheless, why if 19 hijackers on 9/11 were from Saudi Arabia, why did we invade Afghanistan? And the answer is, of course, because Saudi Arabia is in on all of this, although ultimately they may be dropped by their handlers like everybody else. This is the way the world works.
So the commander of Special Operations Command is Gregory A. Smith. He's a U.S. Air Force CCM, whatever that stands for. And they're based at MacDill Air Force Base in Tampa, Florida, in the United States, is their offices. But, you know, it's interesting, I think, that when a little bit of investigative journalism like this, just very well aimed by Diliana there, is what she's really uncovered, is cast iron proof, cast iron evidence that actually the supplying of weapons to the Free Syrian Army and the various factions within Syria trying to overthrow President Assad was directly from the United States Special Operation Command itself, from the Pentagon and the US military.
And all in complete defiance of international law. So everybody involved should A, be arrested, B, be prosecuted, C, sent to prison, and D, in the United States where they have the death penalty, maybe they should be fried. But none of that's going to happen. But of course, ultimately, what goes around comes around. And it's, you know, the assassinator of Soleimani, the guy who gave that order, it's reported in some quarters that he died in an air crash in Afghanistan. So, you know, if you get and Le Mesurier, the British intelligence agent who was involved setting up the White Helmets, he committed suicide, apparently, in Turkey. I mean, if you're involved in these kind of games, you and your family are targets.
If anyone listened to the full version of the interview, which we played a couple of weeks ago with Alex Craner, Martin, they would have heard him saying that it's actually a very dodgy and a dangerous thing to do, to do an assassination like that of Soleimani, because you have to kill the people who've done the assassination, and you also have to kill the people who've killed the people who've done the assassination. Otherwise, there's every possibility that it will leak out and that you may be prosecuted in the future for it. So it's a bit of a risky business,
well,
a high-level assassination.
In the Soleimani case, they boasted about it. So that's not quite the case. It's illegal. They should go to the International Criminal Court for that, shouldn't they? They won't, because the US isn't part of the International Criminal Court. They're not part of the UN Law of the Sea. They're not part of the Chemical Weapons and Biological Weapons Conventions. But they claim to be the international community, even though they don't participate in any of these international courts and forums. And the attitude of that's because that the laws are for others, not for them. And okay, that's the reality.
So finally tonight, we got to look at the Hollywood producer. This is a guy called John Paul Rice, and he has commented this week on the complete lack of coverage in the mass media, which, of course, this is a major problem. Then we've got enormous news stories breaking, but gagging orders, taboo or whatever, nobody is covering this at all. And in this case this week, it's the release of the court papers, which were supposed to have been sealed, then unsealed, and then sealed again after the judge in question had her son murdered. And in this case, these papers have just simply not been reported on, even though there's a wealth of information about a massive extortion network that was being run through Ghislaine Maxwell and Jeffrey Epstein in the United States. So here he is. This is John Paul Rice talking about... really, I mean, he starts off by talking about his film, his own film, which they made as a feature film about the paedophile scandals called A Child's Voice. And then he goes on to say something about his own knowledge of these kinds of child sex rings still going on and still being protected by the mass media, which are there going on in Hollywood right now.
When the Me Too movement started in 2017, I reached out to several of my female actress friends who were prominent in LA. You would know them by name. Many of them you would know by just their look, because you go, oh, that was her in that movie or that movie. And I said, well, what about the children? What about the children? And the response was, we know. But they were silent on it. And it destroyed me because it destroyed my illusion of what rights, human rights were, children's rights were. This is a child abuse system that we have been living in for a very long time, and it's been allowed to go on. And I will not be silent about this because it affects every single one of us. The people on television who smile at you, who tell you stories, who give you news, are the ones who hide all of this from us. They are not talking about the real issues. They are distracting you with division issues. This is a unification issue. When the Maxwell files came out 48 hours ago, I went on MSNBC, I went on CNN.com, and I looked at every single one of their headlines, and there was no mention of it whatsoever. They were talking about John Lewis's funeral. They were talking about Obama versus Trump, all of the bullshit that you and I hear every single day. And it doesn't matter what side of the political equation you're on this. This is a child issue. This is a human issue. This is not a political issue. It has nothing to do with left versus right, Democrat versus Republican, liberal versus conservative, or anything you are or you identify with as in between. We are faced with a crisis of consciousness among the leadership of our banking institutions, of our media corporations, of the Hollywood entertainment industry, of the music industry. This is not about a bunch of young women who were having sex with older men and make it about a bunch of perverts. They raped and tortured these girls against their own free will, no matter whether they paid them or not. If you read the articles and you listen to what Ghislaine Maxwell said about the girls that she picked up in West Palm Beach's trailer parks, she was asked, what about the young girls? What are we going to do to them? What's going to happen to them? She said, they are trash. They are nothing. That's a direct quote from the New Yorker. When I went and looked at edge.org, which you can find out was a multi-billionaire club of people that was financed by Jeffrey Epstein, you can go to edge.org today, look up under people and go to G. You'll see Bill Gates on there as a contributing member of that organization. And you'd have to go back in the Wayback Machine and Internet Archives to look at all the other people. Jeffrey Epstein was right on there. Marina Abramovich is on there. Paul Allen was on there. All the heads of major industries were on there. And if you start reading some of the articles, one of which I have a direct link to that I will share with anybody who DMs me, there is a direct quote on there that said, indeed, human beings are, in our youngest years, among the most useless creatures in all of the animal kingdom. This is how they view children, through science. This is their expression. These are people who have no ground to tell you what to think, what to do. So when they get up there and they start espousing their views on social justice or whatever the hell it is, know that you're hearing a controlled and scripted dialogue that is going through a filter by people who are very powerful, who hold a lot of money, and they are controlling and conditioning all of these people through pedophilia.
Well, he's a Hollywood producer, maker of the film A Child's Voice, John Paul Rice there. He's not name-dropping particularly, Martin, but he's saying that this is actually endemic in one of the most powerful parts of the global media, that is Hollywood.
Yeah, well, the whole point about the Epstein case is it's being presented to the general population as, oh, isn't it nasty, these perverted blokes that are...
Prince Andrew, Epstein. Yeah.
And Prince Andrew, of course, because everybody's heard of him. But, of course, what it is it's an intelligence operation whereby the heads of industries, senior politicians, anybody who's anybody is dirtied up. They get them to have sex with underage boys and girls, and then they're in the pocket of the intelligence agencies concerned. And Epstein and Maxwell, I mean, you know, it's pretty obvious which intelligence agency they work for. It was the Israeli intelligence agency, Mossad, who boast about their success in controlling events, but then are suddenly terribly reticent when everybody says, well, what do you mean by that? I mean, there's a book in the bookshops now, you know, Rise Up and Kill First, which is a load of boasting about Mossad assassinations. And then at the same time, the Israeli state says, but we're the only democracy in the Middle East, and we abide by the rule of law.
Well, we were just now talking about Netanyahu trying to get a war with Iran started and possibly the attack on Beirut being part of all of that. Obviously, if you've got a hard drive with loads of rich and powerful people's control files on all of them with criminal acts that they've been doing with children, that's actually going to make your life a little bit easier in getting a war started.
Certainly is. And that's what's been going on for years. I mean, as we know in this country, the deputy director of MI6, Hayman, he left a package on a bus, child pornography. Police went round, arrested him. And of course, he was let off because he was the deputy director of MI6. And you've got to imagine that the culture inside the intelligence services is one of blackmail. And, you know, that's the strategy, isn't it? And, of course, that allows you to push things in all sorts of directions, doesn't it?
I mean, say even in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, that many people who were in the intelligence services were effectively above the law as they are now today. In fact, they boast about it today, MI5 and MI6 being above the law. That back in those days, this was a convenient cover for people who were homosexuals. For example, nowadays, of course, that's not a crime, but back in those days it was. But they were used, and they themselves, though, would, of course, have been very vulnerable to blackmail. The very people who are supposed to be, guiding and guarding us against political interference. So it does seem as if that was a whole dysfunctional system and probably still is.
Yeah. And I think the idea that they did this because they're homosexuals is not the point at all. It's they basically involved in illegal activities of blackmail, and it's been integrated with organised crime. I mean, Whitney Webb's stuff about this, about the background to the Epstein case, is excellent. People should read it. And this goes back to the 40s and the 30s. And, you know, the organised criminals blackmail senior police officers, public figures, anybody. And, of course, it's a policy of blackmailing everybody. It doesn't do any harm to have a video or a photograph of somebody doing something illegal. And as long as the people know that you've got that, you don't even have to use it. And you don't just go after individual targets either. You want to sweep them all up, which is why Epstein seems to be total buddies with Bill Clinton and with Trump. Because in actual fact, if you're an intelligence operation, you want dirty stuff on all of them, don't you?
Also, what he's describing there really is evil. It's talking about treating children as if they're the most useless animals in the world.
Yeah, well, you've got to understand it from their point of view. As you say, homosexuality is no longer illegal. And if you out somebody as a homosexual, it's not going to cause that much of a shock. Whereas, of course, on the other hand, paedophilia is illegal, and for good reason. And, you know, if you go to prison as a paedophile, you have a pretty hard time. And basically, it's a very effective blackmail tool, isn't it?
It is. Also, I would say one of the things we've done a bit of it there, but I will put the Ghislaine Maxwell PDF of her court documents, which were unsealed and then resealed again. But I mean, none of that's been reported on by the mass media. But I'll put those up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk if anyone fancies looking through them or passing them on to someone that might find them useful in some sort of criminal prosecution, because I think this is one of the most important cases we've ever seen. And the idea that the judicial process can be just messed about and interfered with in this case is just certainly not acceptable. It already has been, quite clearly, with the almost certain murder of Jeffrey Epstein and his inability to testify. But then we know, don't we, that Martin, really, what they're really interested in is those hard drives with the child sex tapes on them from Epstein and Maxwell's properties. They're not really interested in what happens to Ghislaine Maxwell or Jeffrey Epstein themselves.
No. Well, as I said earlier, if you get involved in these games, you can end up dead, like Le Mesurier in Turkey, who supposedly committed suicide by jumping off a two-story building. He obviously knew too much for somebody. And, you know, it may be that Maxwell will protect herself by saying, I'll tell you everything that we did as long as you don't prosecute me. I don't know. But it's quite likely that she may end up dead as well, eh?
Okay, and finally, just to say, I shall be down at the Fountains in Bristol City Centre on Sunday, I think it is, at 2. I've been invited down there. I don't know how much publicity has been done for it to speak about the pandemic, which I won't just be talking about the pandemic. I'll be talking about a few other things as well if I get the chance. And that's an event apparently organised by Piers Corbyn. So we'll see how that one goes. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Download our MP3s and you can listen in the car or anywhere you like. I'll put a few extra full-length interviews up this week, particularly the one we did in the first second hour with Chris Busby, the full version of that, and maybe one or two others as well, because we haven't got time to do all of these things all the time each week. In fact we're way running over time as usual, but anyway, you'll find this show's podcast story links and comment page and our contact details and BCFM's contact details for that matter at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. He's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the politics show live stream at the old time at 5 o'clock next Friday, and you can download it a couple of hours later at thisweek.org.uk and on Radio 4 All. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.